So I'm Eric Weinberg. I'm a voluntary meditation instructor here. And when Lama Kathy is on the road or can't teach for some reason, meditation instructors give Dharma talks. Usually we're working from a book. We, in order to maintain continuity and not just have talks that are kind of scattered all over the place, we found this is a good thing. We're starting a new book today. I love this book, by the way. And guess what? It's out of print. So this is what it looks like. This is from a PDF that's available online. I think because it's out of print, we can probably share it if you can't find it. I need to find out. I haven't done yet. I don't want to break any like publishing laws or anything. But the name of the book is Meditation Advice to Beginners by Bokar Rinpoche. I've been a beginner for a really long time. And I keep, whenever I get some experience or feel like, oh, I've really got some accomplishment or something, two things happen. One is progress stops immediately and I get cast into outer darkness without even a moment's notice. And the other thing is I'm always reminded by a book that I keep handy by Suzuki Roshi, who is a great Zen teacher, and his main book is, in my mind, one of the best Dharma books, is called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and the advice in there is simply strive always to be a beginner. Our idea is, particularly in our culture, that we can learn everything so that we can control everything and we can manage all the details of our life and we become masters, experts. If you think of yourself as a master, usually it's a red flag. I'm reminded also of the Dalai Lama, who every time I've ever seen him, and I've seen him a few times, we treat him like a master, which is proper, I think. But he always says, well, I'm just an ordinary monk. You know, I'm just still a beginner. I think that's really good for all of us. The issues that are in this book are the main issues of meditation is small, but it covers what ends up being the two main forms of meditation. So what I'm thinking is that today's talk is just about the introduction, and I'm going to go through it because it's very good. And I'm going to try to point out some things that we just pass over that we see in a lot of the literature we get, things like conceptual mind. Well, what the heck is conceptual mind? I mean, that's a concept. So we'll talk a little bit about things like that in order to provide a foundation for the rest of what comes. Basically, there are two forms of meditation. I learned this from our friend and teacher and translator, Lama Yeshe Jamso, when he was here and somebody asked him about all the different practices. And he said, well, there are really only two kinds of meditation. First is calming down. Second is waking up. Everything fits into those categories. It turns out that you can't wake up until you calm down. So it's really important that we first learn to calm down. And that's what we'll be beginning today, is to explore this thing called shine, which means calm abiding in Tibetan. It's also known as shamatha. Also gets called mindfulness meditation. And it's generally just one of the healthiest things you can ever do. So before I launch into all of this, I want to begin the way we traditionally begin, with the four-line refuge prayer. And I'll chant it three times. If you know it, please chant it along with me. If you don't know it, please follow along in your heart. The idea is to set the atmosphere for being surrounded by the Dharma, infused by the Dharma, learning and sharing the Dharma. So we take refuge in the Buddha, who is our own enlightened mind, as well as the historical Buddha, who pointed out that it's in there. And the Dharma, which are the teachings that help us discover what he discovered, and the Sangha, which are both the enlightened masters of all time that are actually here with us in various forms, supporting us and also each other. Because community and how we approach these teachings together is really, really important. So if you know the prayer, please join with me. And if you don't know the prayer, follow along in your heart in that way. Sanje chudang soki chognam la Changchu pardu dakni kyab suchi Daki jin so gi pe sonam ki Rola penchir sanje rupar sho Sanje chudang soki chognam la Changchu pardu dakni kyab suchi Daki jin so gi pe sonam ki Rola penchir sanje drupar sho Sanje chudang soki choknam la Changchu pardu dakni kyab suchi Daki jin so gi pe sonam ki Rola penchir sanje drupar sho. Thank you. So Bokhar Rinpoche starts in the general introduction to meditation, saying basically what the Buddha taught in the Four Noble Truths, or what we call the Four Noble Truths. He said, human beings are afflicted by suffering, anguish, and a number of fears which they're incapable of avoiding. Good news, folks. So what else is new, right? He said, the function of meditation is to eliminate those. It's funny going Tibetan to English, but I'm going to insert a little change in translation, not that I know Tibetan. The important thing is to understand that this isn't a magical process, you know, where you get some magical power and you eliminate your enemy because you have, again, mastered something. It's not like that. Really, our lives unfold the way they unfold, and they have any number of difficulties and joys and periods of dullness and boredom. That's true for everybody. That's also true for great masters. We can see that a lot of great masters have a lot of suffering and health problems and all the stuff that we do too. And they're great masters. So what's the difference? They can't make this stuff disappear. They don't really eliminate it. Even the Buddha died when he was 80. Dying happens, you know, and dying's not easy if you're a human being. And so eliminate might not be the right word. what I think the right word is that we change our relationship to it. What gets pointed out are two things. One is that we think that our happiness and our suffering come from external circumstances. If we can just get all this stuff right out here, if we can just get the thing that we want, it'll all be okay. Well, I used to think that. I am now qualified for Medicare. And I can tell you that it hasn't happened that way yet. So I've given up hope in that idea. And meditation is a different path. It's a path of saying, actually, our happiness or this business of eliminating suffering has to do with changing our relationship to what occurs to us, what appears to us, what happens to us, what we make happen in our lives. Our relationship to it is basically, you know, dependent on being obsessed with what we want and obsessed with what we don't want, grabbing for one, pushing another away, and trying to be sort of, I love it when people get bewildered, and this, talking to myself here, and thinking, well, that's just normal, or having some behavior and saying, well, it's normal. That's always some kind of an excuse for a bad relationship inside to what's happening in my life. So the first advice is that when something adverse comes up, something regretful, something you regret, something that you don't like, rather than waving your magic meditation wand to make it go away, is different. The advice is really to lean into it and to experience all of it, but without this, like, I hate it sort of attitude. So by leaning into it and really seeing it, really looking at the thought, really looking at the experience, you actually begin to see that it's not the way you think it is, and it's not what you think it was, and there's probably even a treasure for it. There's a story in the Sufi tradition about this mullah named Nasruddin. Has anybody ever heard of Nasruddin before? They're all teaching stories. They're fabulous. So his best friend Mansur comes across him one night on his hands and knees under a street lamp, looking really hard for something. And Mansur says, what's going on? He said, well, I lost my house key and I'm looking for it. And Mansur says, well, I can help. And he gets down on his hands and knees and they're looking for this key. And after about 15 minutes of really exhausting the search in that area, he says, oh, it's not here. I mean, it's crazy to keep looking here. Where did you lose it? He said, well, I lost it in the house. Then he said, then why are you looking for it out here? He said, because this is where the light is. We do that all the time. So the point is that in meditation, what we're trying to do, this calming down business, is to not be reactive. We're trying to accomplish a state of seeing things as they are, more and more and more, and not reacting to it, either by trying to get more of it if we love it or push it away if we don't love it, but just see it for what it is. That's the first thing. So in terms of eliminating suffering and anguish, I think it's important that we define our terms here. Because I see the great masters, and they have what I would call, if it was in my life, suffering, great difficulty. Heaven knows Karmapa is in this country now, wasn't expecting to be. and will be, I guess, until the middle of summer getting medical treatment. Now, I think it might just be pure exhaustion and probably some other stuff I don't know about, but his life is so demanding, so demanding. People want so much from him. It wore him out. Well, when I get like that, I think of it as suffering. When he gets like that, it's like, I have a problem that I have to respond to here, but I can still work for the benefit of beings. I still can laugh a lot. I can still be present in my life in a state of what we call in Buddhism bodhicitta. So changing meditation helps us learn to change our relationship to what's going on. Won't necessarily help us control all the causes and conditions, all the circumstances, everything that happens. Bokar Rinpoche uses an example, and I think this is a good one. It explains something that comes up a lot. He says, a person with a clean and clear face who looks in a mirror sees a clean and clear face, while the person whose face is dirty and covered with mud sees a dirty, mud-stained face. The reflection in the mirror has no true existence. But we take the reflection as being real. And so the positive or negative nature of our mind is reflected, you know, the clean or dirty state of our mind is reflected. And then he says, it's just an echo of our inner world. And then we try to restructure what's in the mirror. He says, we go to clean the mirror, and no matter how much we clean the mirror, the face is still dirty. We can't change that. This is sort of like rearranging our life without any insight, just trying to grab with what we want and avoid what we don't want without really understanding how everything is relating to each other and to us. There are these three basic things that come up. There's what we call anxiety, which is things must go perfectly, so I must plan endlessly. And there's distraction or ignorance, distraction from our true essence, which is, hey, what's that shining thing over there? Times 8,000 times. And then there's the kind of depressive mind that's just wants to push everything away, and it's saying, I'm tired and nothing's worth the effort. We relate to reality in these ways. It's what, again, a lot of people call normal. Oh, that's normal. Well, that doesn't help much to think that's normal. What really it is a mental habit that happens. It's like this happens, and we're hardwired to respond to it in a certain way. We know from brain science, it turns out, that they've learned this by studying musicians, that practice actually creates a conductive material around axons and neurons, not just in your brain, but in your whole body. And that's why they say athletes, for instance, have muscle memory after they repeat something so many times. Well, what's really happening underneath that is that they've built up more conductive wires, neurons, and axons in their bodies that have more myelin around them, so the impulses travel like faster, what we call instinctively, okay? And then things happen as they respond to situations they're in. If you watch any football, you're going to see a lot of that with football players. Well, guess what? Meditation's like that too, and that's part of the reason we call it practice. So when we're doing shine and something wonderful happens and we are about to react to that and say, oh, this is great, and get like all full of excitement, and instead recognize that it's just a thought and let it go. Or something awful happens and we recognize it as just a thought and let it go. Or we get really, really tired and just dulled out, just spaced out, and recognize that and apply the practice again. It's a little bit like being an athlete. We are actually reinforcing the neurons that'll do that in our daily life. And that's how it works. So when we begin to encounter situations, we actually don't necessarily encounter what we once thought of as a bad situation and react to it as if we just had a bad experience. We might respond to it as a creative opportunity. We might respond to it with spaciousness. We might respond to it with love and kindness and compassion. It all depends how we train. That's why it's really important when you start meditation to set your motivation that you're doing this for your benefit and for the benefit of all beings. Because again, that reinforces that conductive flow of mental energy in a way that is really powerfully positive. Kindness and compassion is ultimately the qualities of Buddhahood. So we just do that right up front. Say, we're going there, all right? It's in this way that we stop cleaning the mirror in hopes of seeing a clean face, and we kind of clean up our conductivity inside. We are actually reinforcing things. By the same token, by the way, if we have a normal response to a situation and just have a kind of, well, that's okay, we're just reinforcing that. We're just reinforcing it. And as we say, that creates causes and conditions for our life. I mean, as the Bible says, as you sow, you shall reap. That's what that means. So if we sow kindness and compassion and find creative ways of filling situations no matter what they are, we're going to build that as a strong kind of mandala that unfolds in our life. And that's really true. So that's the basis for meditation. That's why we do it. We're really, and that's why we call it practice. We really are practicing. We are really building kind of a different relationship, a different muscle memory, if you would call your mind a muscle. That's improper, but I don't know what else to call it right now. And it's totally up to us. So he says, okay, so there are conditions that are necessary for meditation. And I found this to be very helpful. He said, first of all, we must have an intense aspiration to meditate and feel joy at the prospect. Well, I got news for you. I've been attempting to meditate since 1974. Sometimes I have an intense aspiration and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm joyful about it and sometimes I can barely drag myself to the cushion, and that's the truth. So I fail. But there are two things that have helped me in this regard. One of them is that I recognize, I accept as a matter of faith, actually, that I do have the same nature as the Buddha, but it is still, I'm still clean in the mirror. I still haven't cleaned that off yet. So it can do its thing in the universe. But I accept that. And I accept everything is connected. Everything is interdependent. So it's not just for me that I'm getting on that cushion. I realize, and I've seen results in my life that indicate to me that other people do benefit by me being there. And I do believe, and it's just a belief. I have, you know, I'm not enlightened, so I don't have the evidence to show you. But I do believe that there are other beings depending on me getting there and putting some kindness and compassion into this whole interdependent, interconnected system. And if I don't do it, if I don't do what I can do, nobody else can. I mean, because it's what I can do, right? Great rabbi from a couple thousand years ago, Hillel, said, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? In other words, if I don't get on with this life where I can transform my relationship to it in a very positive way, who else can do it for me? Nobody. If I'm for myself alone, what am I? Was his second question. Well, then if I'm for myself alone, obviously, I'm not recognizing that I'm in it with you guys and everybody and everything else, and therefore I'm lost and alone. And have swallowed what the Buddha called a poison called ignorance, and the ignorance is the ignorance of being attached or clinging to self, to an illusory self. So concerned about self. And it turns out this self really doesn't even exist at the ultimate, from the ultimate stage. So when I get it all just right and I'm at the mountaintop, I've been there, by the way. And what happened to me is it all falls apart. All the self-image just collapse. And to me, for me, at that point, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I can only say that because I was a meditation practitioner already, and I knew what to do with that. And the treasure that was underneath that shell, that facade, that false self-image, was a really, really wonderfully gifted life. So, you know, that's the second thing. If I'm for myself alone, what am I? Well, what I am is like living an illusion that's about to collapse sooner or later. That's what I am. And then the third question is, if not now, when? Well, there's only ever now. Right? The past is gone. You cannot alter it. What was. What is it? You give up. What is it in the 12-step program? I think you got to give up all hope of a better past. It's one of my favorite things. What will be, who knows? What I can guarantee you, though, is we're creating the causes and conditions for what will be right now. Sitting here listening to the Dharma is a profound thing in the sense that it's you're creating, and the way you listen to it, because you're creating the causes and conditions for what the next moment is. There's no doubt about this. We've proven that with science. Yes, the Buddha said it, but now we've got physics. That's the way it is. So it's cool to get on that cushion every day, even if you're like me and you don't have quite the enthusiasm and joy and all that that he says you got to have. Because even so, you're taking care of others because of interdependence. It's a little like having a workout buddy. Even when you don't feel like it, you show up at the gym because they're depending on you to be there. It's a little like that. So you've got that. And you also have the goad of creating the causes and conditions that you want your life to unfold with the things the Buddha told you it will unfold with if you calm your mind down. I mean, I don't know for sure. I think I'm starting to experience that now and then. But, you know, an enlightened being, many enlightened beings have told us that's the way it is. I'm going with that. So first off, he says, you know, at least have the aspiration. And if you do it with the right attitude, actually joy will come. He said, next, find yourself an instructor. That doesn't necessarily mean they have to be the Dalai Lama to be your instructor. There's a lot of this, my guru's better than your guru's stuff. That's crap. What you need is a companion who has a little more experience, because we're working with the way we relate to life. You need a fair witness, right? Because your habitual reactions are your habits. There's no way to get outside of that. How can you be objective about yourself, right? So you've got somebody who can see where you're at and say, oh, just make this adjustment or make that adjustment, and it'll help you a lot. You know, you can't, it's difficult to see that for yourself. And generally, most of us don't get inspiration from invisible beings. I mean, I've heard that that can happen. But, you know, it's been great that I've gotten a lot of instruction from some of you and a lot of companionship from all of you. And together, we can help each other figure out, you know, how to best proceed in the path of meditation. So it's really good for us to get together and talk about it. It's really good when you get stuck to ask questions. That's how I wound up here at KTC. I had been a meditation instructor. I mean, I learned meditation in 74, and somewhere in the late 90s, I just got really stuck. And it wasn't a dark night of the soul or anything cool like that. I was just in a blind canyon, and I didn't know what to do. I called up, and Lama Kathy called me back. I left a message. She didn't know me from anybody. And I said, I'd like to meet with you. And she said, fine. And we met. And I told her my whole long story. I won't bore you with that. And after patiently listening to me for way too long, she looked at me and she said, well, I don't know anything about any of that, but I think I can help you. You'll have to start all over at the beginning, though. I said, okay, because I really, really wanted this, you know? I had that aspiration that he was talking about. And ever since then, a lot of people have helped me, a lot, and it's actually what's necessary. It's been necessary because I can't see my own junk. I think some of the things about me that I think are junk are not, and some of the things that I think are just great are junk. And I can't help the way I think, you know? I just, I have that, you know. I had a Jewish mother. You know how you can tell a Jewish mother? This is a bad joke. Or, yeah, well, I blew it already. Do you know how you know you're a Jewish son? That's the question. It's like he takes up his father's business and his mother thinks he's a god. Certain junk gets in your head from that, you know? So it's like, there you go. So we need each other. We need companionship. We need teaching. And then the last thing, the last thing that you need is a place. When you become an expert, you know, some of the need for that, you can meditate in anything with anything. Most of us aren't at that level yet. We're still training these habits and responses in our minds. And life has just got so many distractions. Bokar Rinpoche says, a wild animal living in a high mountain forest cannot endure the agitation of the city. And it's, you know, often an analogy for our minds that our minds are like wild animals. And we put ourselves in unendurable situations. That's part of why we think life is hard, because we're reacting to it all the time, right? We've got that reptilian mind, totally untrained, just constantly, you know, chasing after stuff or running away from stuff. And it's very hard to be still if you put yourself in the middle of a place that reminds you you should be worried about this thing that's going to happen in the future, or ruminating about this thing that happened in the past. So it's good to find a place that is quiet, that is kind of purpose-built, even if it's just a cushion in the corner of a room with maybe a single image of the Buddha, or maybe a candle or an offering bowl. There's a whole thing in the, you know, after you take refuge, about how to set up a shrine at home. That, you can do that. But it doesn't even have to be that elaborate, really. It's just your place to go, and when you sit down, you know what's going to happen next. You're going to start on this path of calming down, where whatever comes up, whether it's a rumination about the past, a plan, or an anxiety about the future, you just let it go and be present. So you get to that, if not now, when? Because you bring your mind back to the now. And that's the point. So that as life unfolds, it's just now and now and now. And now, no matter what it is, and you have a relationship to it that's kind and compassionate. It's why when something comes up that you perceive as being negative, you don't run away. In fact, you might lean in and you find a way to forgive whatever or whoever, including yourself, for whatever situation that might be, and cultivate forgiveness, right? And kindness and compassion. Use everything that way. That's what we're in training for. That's what actually, as he says, eliminates the suffering. There just isn't suffering in kindness and compassion. There's no suffering in forgiveness. It's the truth. So next he talks about, so that's where to meditate. Next he talks about how to meditate. Well, we talk about this a lot, so I won't talk about it a lot. But basically, it's take whatever object you want. Go sit in a quiet place. Take a deep breath and let go of all the stale stuff. And bring your mind to your breath and let it rest on your breath. The truth is that the mind is what's unhappy. It's not everything out here that's creating it. It's the mind being dissatisfied with it. We generally don't have what we want and want what we don't have. And, you know, we don't have what we want. Yep. And don't want what we have. Yep. That's it. And so when we sit up straight because of this energy system in our body. In Sanskrit, it's called prana. You work with prana in yoga class and all that all the time. Tibetans call it subtle winds. And they say that the production of thoughts is linked with the circulation of these winds. And the agitation of the body causes agitation of the channels and the winds, which in turn induces mental turbulence. Top secret teaching is right in this book for beginners. Then you bring down the activity of speech. You don't talk. We stop talking. Because the formation of sounds also depends on the activity of the winds. Talking too much disturbs them and increases the production of thoughts, while remaining silent aids the meditation. In this way, tranquility of speech and body creates the conditions for inner calm by avoiding the production of excessive thoughts. He goes on to say, just as a rider is at ease when he or she handles his or her mount well, the mind will rest when body and speech are under control. That's an important thing. And then he says, there are some false notions concerning meditation. Some people think reviewing and analyzing their life, thinking about what's going on, solving all the problems, the 8,000 things, is meditation. It's not meditation. Contemplating the future and all the options and what would be good, what would be kind, what would be compassionate, what would bring me closer to Buddha, that is not meditation. Those are just thoughts. And when you recognize the thought, you let it go. That's all. It can be a sacred thought. It could be a profane thought. God could kiss you on the lips. It's just a thought. You could have the most profound insight in the history of all literature of spirituality. It's just a thought. I used to, when I first learned to meditate, I didn't think that. Man, I was having like experience. So I'd keep a little notebook and I'd write them down. I'll tell you what. I read that stuff not just a few years ago. I had that old notebook out. What a load. Oh my gosh. Horrible stuff. So that's the point. That's one, another reason we need teachers. We fool ourselves into what's really profound. We don't get it right. So all of that stuff, thinking, contemplating future or past events, being romantically involved with your own insights, all of that, that's a mistake. The third kind of mistake is to settle for some blurred kind of spaced out silence. This can happen when you meditate, actually. You can kind of get in the zone and it's really quiet and there are no thoughts. And it's like, but you also kind of get sleepy. And what we call torporous, that's also a problem. A state of meditation has a light quality to it. And by light, I mean not just physically light, but also lucidity. You know, it's like Nasruddin leaving the street lamp and going in his house, but turning on the lights in the house. It's like we have that. So we're aware of our awareness at that point, and it's open and spacious and huge. As our friend Ed Powers likes to say, vast is good. So when you're just feel this, the vastness of a clear sky on a sunny day, it's like that. So if you get kind of cloudy and, you know, more like a cloudy sky and a little, you know how it's nice to take a nap in on a drizzly day, you get a little nappy like that, that's also something that has to be dealt with. And usually, if we just tighten up our practice and bring our attention more sharply to our object of focus, which again can be the breath, it could be a mantra, it could be the visualization of a little ball of light in front of your forehead, it's whatever it is, tighten up on that just a little bit and this grayness will dissipate. So when we do that, that's what's called shine. And it's really important to build up that mental or mental muscle memory, if you will, because as that becomes applicable to every moment, we begin to become ready for that second stage of meditation, which actually he talks about in the end of this book. So stay tuned and do a lot of shine so you're ready to get the good of it, which is waking up. Once we're non-reactive and quiet and open and spacious in our life with whatever arises, then that space in our life is ready to be suffused with light and insight. And that's what stage two is. There's about 7 minutes left. And I want to say one more thing and open it up for questions if you have any. And the last thing is this. I brought this. This is a quote from my friend Longchenpa, who's a great master from about, I don't know, 1,000 years ago or so. And he says, as was said, you must practice because the barrier between samsara and nirvana has to be opened now, when you have the chance. If you practice profound dharma with perseverance, enlightenment will be gained in this life. If not, merely having gained a high level of empowerment or the like, and then sometimes when you have time to spare, giving a little thought to it will not help when the Dharma is needed. And besides, if you do not meditate, it is certain that you will have to wander in samsara. What does he mean by this? Well, I mean, samsara is just wandering in the world of our reactivity. That's what it is. So yeah, if we don't find a way of training our minds to let go into openness, by definition, but doing it now when we have time and the leisure and the teaching and the companions and everything available to us is critical. Why? Well, to be blunt about it, one day we're all going to die. That's it. Death is not easy. Even the best of deaths is not easy. And as things shut down, some of you know, I just went through this with my father, but I've been through it a few times. I'm on a little team of people here that helps people at the time of their death. They're specific meditations in Tibetan practice for the time of death. For somebody who has practiced just this, just Shine, being able to let go at that moment is profoundly important. Why? Well, everything we think, do, and say is really comes to us from our senses, right? We've got six senses. What we see, we relate to. What we hear, we relate to. What we smell, what we feel, what we taste, we relate to all those. And the mental consciousness is considered a sixth sense. What we think, we relate to. And by practicing meditation, we learn to change our relationship to those. They don't go away, heaven forbid. But we learn to give them spaciousness, and we learn to develop insight. And as you die, what happens? One by one, all those things shut down. When they're shutting down, it's too late to learn how to let go. Because it takes practice and it takes time to build up this muscle memory thing. So, you know, it's like, what does they say? When the house is on fire, it's too late to try to learn how to build a fire truck. It's a little like that. So we have this incredible opportunity right now, and we all have a certain outcome eventually. We don't know if it's this afternoon or 50 years from now or more, but we're all going to go through that. And to be able to let go at that moment, what the Buddha taught is your consciousness goes on. There's cause and effect still, you know, what conditions you create will have a result. And if you let go into kindness and compassion, because that's what you do, as they say, you'll be reborn in a pure land. You'll be reborn in the presence of a Buddha. Well, guess what? That's it. Kindness and compassion is the Buddha. That is. So we're training for the inevitable last moment of our life. And that's the last thing I want to leave you with as a kind of somber motivation. It's important that we hear this. It's important that we practice this. It's important that we share this with each other. It's important that we do it because we're going to be companioning each other right up to the end. And this is the only way, ultimately. They say only Buddhas can help. Well, so this is the only way that we can really help each other when the chips are down and help ourselves. So anyway, if there are any questions, I should have finished that on a joke. I can see all these serious faces. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you, Eric. I very much enjoyed that. A couple of thoughts, and I'm just trying to connect these in my mind a little bit. So you started out, and you were talking about that book, Zen Mind, Beginner Mind.
Yes.
Beginner's Mind. And I read that 12 or 15 years before I ever became a Buddhist.
Yeah.
And I wrote down a quote from that. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to thinking about that in the context of what you were talking about with the connections, the connectivity, mm-hmm. and the axons and neurons and myelin and all of that, that our muscle memory, you were talking about it in from a good building a new habit for mm-hmm. meditation. But it's that same tendency for habit that's gotten us in trouble anyway, mm-hmm. and it turns us into experts where things just flow through too quickly without us realizing what's going on, and that's our reactivity. So I kind of got to thinking about the paradox between we're building a helpful habit, but ultimately we want to get to that point where we're beyond habit.
Right.
As they say, where everything arises as fresh.
Yes.
And anyway, those were just the thoughts that were going through my head.
Those are good thoughts. Actually, there's a Q&A, a question similar to that at the end of this chapter. Let me see if I can find it. Let's see what Bokar Rinpoche says about that. Yeah. So, the question here comes from a similar place, and it's a good one. I have my own answer, but his is going to be better. This question is, what bothers me about meditation is the word method. A method is something which organizes, conditions, and orients the mind. I wonder how one can attain something which is unconditional and unoriented with these methods. Is that kind of close?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is.
So, and there's a little more to the question, but I think that's the essence. So, he says, once the ultimate nature of mind is realized, there's no longer any need for methods. However, to realize the state beyond method, one must rely on them. Without this support, it's impossible to realize the ultimate state. The methods do imply a progression contained within a time frame. However, it is by relying on time that one attains the timeless. So, here's the way I put it. I have a kind of a visual mind. So when we start out, we're like in the jungle alone, and there are a lot of tigers. And those tigers want to eat us because that's what tigers do. And when we learn meditation and we take refuge in meditation, essentially, it's like, all of a sudden having tiger cage. We can be there and they can't get in the cage, but we can see out in the jungle. And then there's a progression that happens where you kind of get a little bit better at relating to things because you get used to it. And I would say it's muscle memory, but the point of making the proper aspiration first is that I remember to go to openness rather than the closed habit. So every thought that comes up, I let it go and I go to openness. So yeah, that's a habit. And what happens when you get used to that is all of a sudden you're wandering in the jungle and you're free, but the tigers are in the cage. And then enlightenment is when there's no cage, you ride the tigers. I'm just supposing that. I haven't done it yet. I still need a little protection from my tigers, let me tell you. So anyway, I think the idea is that that's one of the reasons we rely on people who are a couple steps ahead on the path, is because they can help us with our progression. And without that, yeah, we can get really lost. and we can just develop another habit, and it's just another habit. Maybe a healthier one, which is not a bad thing, but still not going towards enlightenment, which is what I think you were talking about. Is that right?
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. Yeah, well, muscle memory, that's, I have like muscle memories of walking a lot when I was younger. Don't do it much these days, but I did hike the Appalachian Trail on Wednesday before Thanksgiving to disperse some ashes from a loved one. And, yeah, I sat and meditated for, I don't know, half an hour. And, that's about the only thing that's related to the topic. I was saying, when you said the Karmapa is in New Jersey, did you say he was convalescing, his teacher was convalescing?
Yes and yes. He originally came because one of his old attendants got very ill. And he happens to be the Lama that lives at the New Jersey KTC, which is a beautiful house surrounded by woods. It's gorgeous. And when he was here, he went for a routine checkup, and he's had some fatigue issues. And they decide, I don't know any more than that. Nobody seems to know. And nobody who does know is talking. But apparently he's resting and getting some treatment. We don't know what. You know, I don't know. All I do know, or what I've been assured of, is not life-threatening. But he needed a little care. So he's getting it. That's a good thing.
When I heard that, I had this aspiration that I should take him on the Appalachian Trail to like my favorite meditation spot.
Oh.
See what he thinks.
What a good idea. Email New Jersey KTC just on a lark. Seriously, and tell them you'd like to do that. Who knows?
All right.
You might be able to go for a long walk with Karmapa. That'd be great. I think that's a great idea. See what can happen in spacious mind. I would never have come up with that. That's brilliant.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for your teaching. Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay. Almost.
Sounds like it's all in my mind.
It is.
Yeah, right. Waxing and waning on your commentary on changing our relationship to this stuff, and I could identify wholly with your description. You know, I can't even remember the semantics, but I was like, yeah, that's me. So something that I've been thinking about, you know, for me, I kind of felt stuck for the last 3 years. And something I had heard recently, won't say where, but talked about, you know, when all else fails, to try gratitude and acceptance, which, you know, in the theme of, you know, changing our relationship with suffering and, mm-hmm. and this samsaric existence, I thought that was pretty great. But to go further with that, you know, I was talking to someone about the idea of acceptance, and part of that I think is, and sometimes I don't think we always do a great job of really getting into this. I can get into that in a second, but you know, how we truly feel about a situation.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I'm all about not expecting to get what I want when I want it and how I want it, but for me, in my mind, like 3 years is a long time.
Yeah.
I'm going to temper my comments, but let's just say I really didn't like that. And then I started thinking about that. And one of the things is, you know, it's like we're only as sick as our secrets. And I think we really have to expose our dark side. And, you know, I think that, and I'm guilty of this, and I would say probably a lot of you here are similar to me, is, you know, we come in here with our church clothes on. And, you know, everyone wants, you know,
I like it when I was out in California, I would say, well, everyone's a guru, right? You were like, everyone has a better, you know, they think they're guru. You know, I would say, well, certain parts of the country you go to, I don't think as much here, but everyone's a guru. And I think for me, at least in the past, that kind of gets in the way of being able to change our relationship to things, because we aren't really ready to accept what we really think, which a lot of time, I don't know about you all, but I sure ain't enlightened, and I get salty as H-E double hockey stick or kids in the room. But anyway, I have to brush up against that and see that before I can really truly change my relationship to a situation. I don't know about you, but I mean, that seems to what works for me, and I don't know if there's any scripture on that or teachings that you're aware of, but I just wanted to kind of bring that up.
Well, for one thing, everybody's a guru, and yeah, that's like, remember the first point is that this isn't about everything outside, this is about everything inside.
Sure.
This enlightenment business, this happiness business, is an inside job.
Right.
So you're exactly right.
Right.
It's a matter of going within. When somebody's running around saying, I'm a master, it's probably a red flag.
Right.
Yeah. And I think there's a Hawaiian spirituality.
Cool.
It's not very old.
Right.
Called Ho'opo Ono or something like that.
I've heard of this.
And it's very simple. It's very simple. Actually, a psychiatrist probably 60, 70 years ago, I think, kind of came up with this and built its life around it and has some people that are also doing it. And it turns out it's very powerful. A client of mine taught me this. And it's simple. It's when you're in adversity, once again, lean into it.
Right.
Always, always, always forgive. Forgive yourself, forgive others. Forgiveness has to be in front of you all the time. Then thankfulness, and you mentioned gratitude, and finally love.
Right.
And those four things applied in any order, doesn't have to be in a particular order, are transformative for your life and the lives of others.
Right.
And that sounds about right to me, because that goes right along with the four immeasurables, which
right.
is the teaching you're looking for in Buddhism, really,
right.
at that point. Mm-hmm. So I think as a practical matter, that's something that you can carry with you. And when you're getting a feeling in the middle of, look, we're here. You feel stuck for 3 years, but it's really when you felt unstuck 6 years ago, or whatever,
right?
You were still here, right?
Right.
So the issue is your relationship to being here.
Right, sure.
So those are things that you can kind of carry in your hip pocket, and I'm feeling stuck. I forgive life for that. I forgive myself for being stuck.
Right.
You know?
But, my point being...
And that's all we can do is to start to change the way we respond to things.
Sure. My point being is you gotta recognize how you truly feel about it, though.
Absolutely.
Before you can even apply the tools. If you don't know where you're at or what's going on, then you can't change your relationship to it.
That's totally right. That's one of the gifts of meditation off the cushion, is you begin to recognize things because you're not reacting to them all the way.
Right.
And it's like, oh, there's that one. You know?
Right.
For me, when that happens, it's mostly these things are like not new.
Right.
They're old friends. They're old, you know, and it's like, what is it? Also, Suzuki Roshi said, you'll get many visitors, sometimes annoying old relatives, like a feeling of being stuck. Well, you know, whenever things slow down, I feel stuck, for instance.
Right.
So you let them in the front door, and you let them out the back door, just don't serve them tea.
Right. No, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Arvin. Well, that was great. Thank you all for being attentive and for staying much longer than anticipated. So let's take a moment and just dedicate the merit of having listened to, meditated on, contemplated the Dharma. So in order to dedicate the merit, just open your heart, feel its spaciousness and how much light is just everywhere, like the dawning sun, and send it out to all beings to touch them and to vibrate their hearts so they also can feel the spaciousness and the light of being touched by this Dharma. Thank you.